Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. This time, however, I'm joining forces with Lori, Amy, and Haley of Hugo Girl, which is a podcast similar in format and content to this one. It's a fun discussion, and I hope you enjoy it, so I'm going to toss it over to my past self to introduce the episode. So we have the crossover that I think the internet has been waiting for since its inception, pretty much, the crossover of the Hugo's There podcast and Hugo Girl. And so I think after this, we can shut the internet down. What do you think, ladies?
I mean, it's definitely our internet now.
Absolutely.
So we can do whatever we want.
Yes. Yeah, it's our internet and everyone else is just living in it. Right. So in this case, I am joined by Lori, Amy, and Haley of Hugo Girl, or kind of the better way to say it is I'm joining them for a conversation about To Your Scattered Bodies Go, which is the 1972 Hugo Award winner by Philip Jose Farmer. So hi there, ladies.
Hello.
Howdy.
Hey.
So one thing that I like to do on my podcast is to kind of get to know my guest. And if they have a podcast, talk about, you know, where did that come from and all of that kind of information. So I would like to go individually and hear kind of each of your stories about your journey as a science fiction fan, and also hear about how the podcast came about. So maybe one person should talk about the podcast, but I'd like to hear from everybody. So why don't we start with Lori?
Well, I'll defer to Haley on how the podcast started, because I think Haley invented it.
Cool.
But I guess my science fiction journey is fairly short, I guess. I don't know. When did I start reading books, guys? I remember the first time I got into fantasy, which was in high school. And in high school, I was kind of mean about it. I had a lot of friends who read a lot of books with dragons on the covers, and I was like, sure, that seems dorky. Not really acknowledging that I myself was plenty dorky. And then I read the Dragon Prince series by Melanie Ron, probably when I was like 15 or 16, and I ended up reading it like four more times over the course of my teens and early 20s. And then I read The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, and then I think that really opened my mind to sci-fi and fantasy. And then I had read a few of the books on the Hugo list, and I read a lot of Neil Gaiman. So when Haley and Amy approached me about doing this, I was all in.
Cool. Yeah, and I think he's got two winners on the list, right, Gaiman?
American Gods, and does he have something else? I'm not sure.
Yeah, the Graveyard book.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. I haven't read that.
Yeah.
And I had also read a lot of Orson Scott Card and was a fan of the Ender's Game series.
Okay. All right, you want to move on to Amy?
Sure. Hello.
Hi there.
My journey. I believe that I think my intro was probably, I'm going to say it's probably Stephen King, actually. And I don't think a lot of people lump him in with science fiction and fantasy, but I kind of do in my brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I read a lot of Stephen King, and then it sort of led me into a sort of dark urban fantasy kind of place, and then that sort of morphed into science fiction fantasy. But I think really when I got going on it, I was already in my late 20s, and I had a boyfriend who had me read the Game of Thrones Song of Ice and Fire series.
Okay.
And after I read that, it was on.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and I did steal my brother's copy of Ender's Game back when he was in high school, because he didn't want to read it, and I read it, and that's when I knew I would like science fiction, but I didn't really pursue that until later. So I don't know, I'm a latecomer, I think, to a certain degree, but yeah.
Nice. All right, how about you, Haley?
Alrighty, I'm going to wind both those questions together into a single coherent answer, or I'm going to try to.
Sounds good.
So my science fiction journey began probably when I was born. I'm from space. No, I'm the baby from 2001.
When you were born on Alderaan?
No, Alderaan's gone. There's never been a time in my life when Star Wars hasn't been a time in my life. Like, I don't remember my first watch. It's always just been in the back. And then in seventh grade, I got really into the Star Wars Expanded Universe in like 1995.
Okay.
I read a book called Tales from Jabba's Palace. And like, it basically takes a characters that have 1 minute of screen time and then like concocts these awesome backstories. And so that kind of got me into it. And then off and on throughout my life, I've just, you know, found books that just are about space, whether it's hard or soft. And then in 2011, I had a period of unemployment, and I was like, trying to fill my days. And so I started a series of blogs, and one of them was Hugo Girl, and I was going to go through and read all the Hugo award-winning novels and blog about them. I did not, but I still have the WordPress site. And then I have an ex who had a podcast, and I kind of got to see it up close, and it looked really cool. And so then I had this idea that had been like kind of percolating for a couple years. And so then I approached Amy and Lori, and they were down. So
Nice.
Here we are.
And we really like to hear ourselves talk, so the rest is history.
Yeah, yeah. So this is something I haven't heard from you on your podcast. How did you all meet?
I can answer that. This is Lori. Haley and I met in law school, so all three of us graduated from law school. But okay. Amy, you graduated a couple years before us, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so Haley and I were in law school at the same time, and we had a class together. I think it was our last semester of law school, so we didn't actually know each other before that. But we had a class together and quickly got to be good friends. And then I met Amy through Haley.
I came to your wedding.
And I don't know if I know how you guys know each other.
And me and Amy met through email introduction from a friend, because I was a first year in law school and Amy had graduated already. But me and Amy have very similar lives. We're both from Savannah, Georgia, and then we both went to UGA, and then we both went to law school. So,
and we have a lot of mutual friends, but we just never met somehow. And then so she like reached out to me sort of, I guess, out of the blue on on the emails. And then we met up for a drink and the rest was history.
Nice.
It's true.
Law school, bringing people together and taking all their money.
Right. Yeah. All right. So maybe we should move into talking about the actual book. When we first started, you know, basically as soon as we became aware of each other's podcasts, we started kind of scheming and figuring out what we could do for a crossover. And this was the one that, this is the title that came up. And I don't know who it was that wanted to do this. So can whoever wanted to do it speak up and defend your choice?
Sure. So when I was reading all these books years ago, I didn't finish most of them. I'm a notorious not finisher of books. And I think this one is an okay one not to finish. But I think this book is fascinating for the idea that it presents. I think that's true of a lot of science fiction. The execution sometimes is not the best, but this is one of the books that I think about the most frequently, probably, in terms of like how cool it is, the idea. But yeah, there's reading it again. Oof, parts of it made me angry for sure.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll get back to that. So maybe we should start with kind of general impressions on the book, and then somebody should do like a, you know, kind of non-spoiler synopsis of it. Although I'm not sure how much it can be non-spoilery. I don't think the book is so much about the plot, but but yeah, we can cover that when we get to it. But I mean, I'll speak up first here and say I did enjoy this one. I thought it was like Haley said. I mean, it's an interesting concept. The execution is interesting, but it's and we'll get into this when we get into the plot, right? It's kind of Farmer's way of being able to throw whatever characters he wants together and see what happens. And so that was kind of, you know, it made it a positive experience reading it for me. But there's a lot of it in it that I kind of shook my head and went, okay, that's 1972 talking, I suppose, which is actually my birth year. So I should connect to this one.
It's maybe good that you don't.
Yeah, maybe good. <That's
laughs> I can take the stab at the plot summary. This is the elevator pitch that I tell to people when I tell them that there's some weird books out there that won Hugo Awards. Uh-huh. Okay, so the book starts, people are kind of floating hairless, naked in space. It's unclear. But basically what happens is that it turns out that when humans die, they are all regenerated into this river world on the banks of a river with no hair. They're in the prime of their life. They're 25-ish years old, which reading this as a 36-year-old, the first time I read it when I was 25, it makes me sad now to be like, oh, those were my golden days. And so the cool idea of it, though, and I think the part that's at the heart of the book, is that every human being that has ever lived is now living in this new place. And there's like 36 billion total from all the humans that have ever lived. And I just find that so fascinating because there's so many human beings for whom their stories will never be told. You know, the 7th century Italian milkmaid, you know, lost to the sands of time. But the idea that we could all be reborn together, I think, is just incredibly powerful. And so the book focuses on Richard Burton, who was not Liz Taylor's wife. No, the 19th century explorer. And then you meet other various characters throughout history from different time periods, most notably Hermann Göring from Hitler's circle of friends. And then they just wander about. I was sad to find that most of humanity is still kind of crappy to each other. And then there's boats, and yeah, not a ton happens, but it's the way that the people built this river world. The ethicals, the people that someone had to be putting this together, puts people like together purposely in like weird ratios. Like, okay, this part of the rebel will be 30% 19th century people, 20% 15th century people, and then a scattering of everybody else.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, food is provided for. There are these things called grails, which are basically like, in my mind, they look kind of like wider lightsabers, and they're always with you. And then you go and put them into this rock, and then it fills it with narcotics or bacon or what have you. Yeah, so that kind of takes care of the nasty plot device of needing a sustenance, but don't worry about it.
Right.
And then there's, yeah, I really like the idea that there'd be cavemen too, not just Homo sapiens, but, you know.
Right, yeah. So when you said that all of humanity, it's also some near humans and at least one alien.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm. But it's also not all of humanity because it's missing anybody who basically had any problems, like mental problems.
Oh, or I forgot about
like
that.
Anything like that. Yeah. Like it's missing children under the age of 5.
Right. Well, Haley, I'm not sure that I got a solid impression of what you think of this book. It sounded like it hit you differently at your current age than it did when you were 25.
So I was thinking about this in the car today, about how to talk to this book. So the last book we read in our podcast was Dune. And I love Dune's ideas, hate the writing.
Right.
Just like the way that he composes his prose is not my favorite. But this book, there are two ways we can talk about this. We can just talk about the plot and the ideas, or we can critique it from like a really angry lady standpoint, which that's not always the most fun on every podcast. But
right.
I was thinking that like if my daughter, if I had a daughter and she read this book, I would be so embarrassed. And like, I don't know if I'd let her read it because there's a wife character trope that, you know, was in a lot of movies when men are the main character. And then there's like what this book does to women, and it was just kind of crappy to me. So
yeah,
I had a really hard time reading this book up until around the middle. I would read four paragraphs and then angrily put it down and walk away and not be able to read it. And I honestly found the misogyny very grating, and so it was just difficult for me to get into it, I think. And so I found myself picking up other things and stuff. But once they got, I don't want to do spoilers, but once they got on their boat and started upriver, it got a lot more interesting to me because the focus stopped being on what does everybody look like, you know, and that sort of thing. And
yes,
they were talking more about the world, which is the really interesting part of this book to me, which we've
You mean mentioned. Instead of describing that this lady was lovely, except she had her lips were too big?
She would be so pretty if she would just, yeah, all yeah. that. But once I, and also, I don't know if anybody here watches The Good Place, but once I started thinking of it as The Bad Place, it actually got a lot easier to read because it was like, oh, this is just one big torture chamber and they're just right. driving each other crazy. And that's the test. So
The Good Place is also a Hugo winner.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
At some point, I'm going to do like patron only content that's other media, like best dramatic presentation and television and that kind of stuff.
Ooh.
Just because I want to do it. But yeah, that's a good comp, actually. I hadn't thought of that because one thing that I do like to do is like what if you were going to recommend this book to someone and they had consumed this other media, you know, what other media would you say is similar or sort of related?
Oh, I definitely think this has some parallels with The Good Place. It's a lot of philosophy, a lot of, you know, navel gazing, but also a lot of how do these people interact when they're put into this controlled environment. And and once I started kind of thinking of it in those terms, it got a lot more interesting to me as a lot more. I think I was trying to read it for plot when I first started reading it. And once I started reading it more for idea, I started liking it much more.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're reading it as the Stanford prison experiment, but with all of humanity along a river, then that's interesting.
Right. Yeah. And in terms of plot, you're better off getting an airport novel if you want just pure plot.
I know. I love a plot though.
Yeah, science fiction, it's hard sometimes. It's so many of them are just thought experiments gone awry.
Yeah.
Which is weirdly what I like about it, but
it can be tough, too, to, you know, read the mind of what was the author going for here. And then there's the whole, you know, the question of, right, how much does author intent really matter? But that's a different question. Lori, what were your thoughts about this book?
So I appreciate that Haley has pointed out to me that a lot of sci-fi is really just about ideas because I am a plot reader. I guess most of us are plot readers, but I am always looking for the story when I open a book. And so that's been a helpful perspective for me in reading some of these books as a less experienced sci-fi reader. So I think it helps me enjoy it more. But that being said, I did like this book, and I went through it pretty quickly because I was desperate to know what happens at the end. Right. And I guess I don't want to get into spoilers. No, I don't know if I can spoil it. but I did read very quickly. And as far as the misogyny, I mean, it's certainly steeped in it. But I found surprisingly that it didn't bother me because it was just almost cartoonish. It's just a nonstop onslaught of this person's bust and this person's figure. And so, I mean, at a point, I just
very
had to laugh.
Figure.
And, you know, on our show, we have the segment Boob Talk, because I noticed that it seems that male sci-fi and fantasy writers are really preoccupied with, well, and I don't want to limit it to sci-fi and fantasy, but
sure, yeah.
male novelists are really preoccupied with describing to us the breasts of all of their female characters. So
yes.
I keep a running set of notes on that when I'm reading each book. So that actually sort of becomes a game for me. So I have fairly detailed records of all of the descriptions of the women in the book. So instead of getting mad at it, every time there was another particularly colorful description, I wrote it down and I laughed pretty hard. And then I read a good bit about Richard Burton, and it seems like Farmer probably got him pretty true to life.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed it from start to finish, and I thought that the pacing of it was great. It was easy to read quickly because the chapters were short. And so in general, I enjoyed it, even though it's not really too much actually happens.
Right. I'm trying to think if it makes any sense to continue talking in general terms and non-spoilers, or if we should just go ahead and dive in. That way we can just talk about whatever comes to
mind. I can't really
mind.
Think of a way to spoil it.
The spoiler is that nothing happens, right. That you don't get an answer.
Right. There it is. So we are now officially in spoiler talk. Has anybody read further in the Riverworld series?
Nope. No, but I kind of want to.
No.
I was thinking that you could do it literally infinity books based on whatever characters you wanted to do, which is kind of like a neat plot device.
Oh, yeah, that would be fun. But that for that reason, I didn't want to read another one because I got to the end and I was like, oh, I have to find out what happens next. And I'm like going straight to Amazon to order the next book. And then I see it's like the next book is about the adventures of Samuel Clemens. Right. And I was like, no, nothing against Samuel Clemens, but I want to know what happens on Burton's adventure. Yeah.
The book version that I have, actually, that I got from Barnes & Noble Nook is just called Riverworld, and it contains To Your Scattered Bodies Go and The Fabulous Riverboat. And I, like you, I immediately just flipped over to the next book and thought, okay, I want to find out, you know, what happens with Burton. And yeah, it's not about him in the next book. He does recur in the series, but it's not like you have the immediately after the events of To Your Scattered Bodies Go. So,
I'm the opposite. I want to see what Mark Twain wants to do. I want to see what Joan of Arc is up to. Mm. I would read all of them.
That's what I was just thinking. I actually want someone to rewrite some of these books. I would love to. Yes, I'm the same, Haley. I'm like, can we follow some female adventurers? Can we find out what happens with all these other? Yeah, I would love to keep reading other people.
Yeah.
That would be fun if Joan of Arc was the protagonist in one of them and she meets Richard Burton and tells us what he looks like in great detail.
Yes.
He had such a big mustache.
He'd be really cute if not for that big scar on his cheek.
Lacking the mustache, it made him, you know, seem weak, right?
Right. I mean, he's not nearly as masculine.
There are a couple adaptations of Riverworld, actually. I checked out from my library I think it's 2010, 2012, something like that, sci-fi version that has a bunch of leftover people from Battlestar Galactica and Highlander and other series that were shot in Canada. And there was a character in that was like a Japanese warrior princess kind of person. She was super badass, too. So I was hoping that she would be in this book, but she wasn't. Okay, so spoiler talk. We can take it any direction that anybody wants to. So I don't, like I've kind of said over Twitter as we've been talking about this, I don't want to constrain anything that you guys normally do. And so anybody has any ideas where they want to take this, any segments that you want to hit, let's do it.
I have a lot under boob talk, but I know you keep it pretty PG, so I don't know if you want the boob talk segment.
I'm totally fine with it. You just gave the proviso, right? That this episode may be, you know,
PG-13.
There we go.
Every time they started talking about women's bodies, I just wrote eye roll real big in the margin of my book. And so I'm just flipping through and looking for the word eye roll, and it's a lot, you guys. It's a lot.
Yeah. So I guess I would say this, like, I can see that that's definitely a negative thing, right? That it's dwelling on almost kind of the male gaze, right? Of all these female characters. But it's not, some of those unflattering descriptions or overly detailed descriptions aren't just limited to women. Because like the first time it introduces Lev Rausch, the Jewish character, it just focuses on how big his nose is. And I was like,
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I absolutely
noticed
that.
Plenty of racism.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's an equal opportunity discriminator.
Exactly. And part of it, I think, is your point of view character is a, 18th century person, 19th century? And so
19th century.
All the baggage that comes with that. And you can, I don't know, if you want to, you can kind of say, okay, this isn't, the views expressed by Richard Burton did not necessarily reflect the staff and management of Jose Farmer's estate. Mm-mm. But yeah.
Yeah. Well, and it seems true to, so I read, I'm now a scholar of Burton because I read the really lengthy Wikipedia entry. And he did have a complicated relationship with the Jewish community. So I think it might be true to the actual person that he would have described somebody in those terms.
Yeah.
But how, you know, it's hard to know how much of that is Burton, how much of that is Farmer.
Well, that's just it. Like, out of 36 billion humans that have ever lived, he purposely chose Richard Burton to anchor the novel and to view it through his eyes.
I have a theory about that.
I did too.
I did too.
And my theory is that he's the only one that knew all the things he needed to know in order to plausibly move the plot forward.
Yeah. And the languages in particular.
Yeah. Same thing with Frigate. Same thing. Mm-hmm.
Well, Frigate is Farmer though, right?
Right.
That's what I think. He's that's the stand-in for Farmer, yeah. That's
yeah.
What I'm thinking. He's the one that, you know, hand-wrings about all the horrible things that are going on and everything. But and I would agree with you that we can't ascribe the things that Burton is saying to Farmer, except for there's all the other problems with the way he treats women. It's not just Burton.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, every time they have a plot point, someone gets raped.
Yeah.
I will say, as devil's advocate and as a woman, that for 99.99% of history, women were just set pieces, though, sadly.
But there's also the choices he made of which women to put in this book. There are a lot of strong women. There's women adventurers. There's writers. There's suffragettes. You know, there's he could have chosen any number of stronger women to put in this book, and he didn't, you know, and I think that says something.
Yeah. Or why not make Kaz female, right? The Neanderthal character doesn't have to be male as well.
Well, of course he does. Otherwise, how would he be strong?
Exactly.
I mean, that said, I did love Kaz. I thought he was a tremendous character.
I did too. I loved him. I wanted more out of the Tel Centauri character.
Oh, me too. I have in my stray notes section, why is he in the their troop? And of course, you know, he gives us he's sort of the explanation for why everybody's here now. There are no humans living at this point because of what happened with on Earth when he was there.
Right.
But then we don't get anything else from him. And I think it's so neat. And then it's sort of a missed opportunity because I was really looking forward to hearing more from him and about him and how he interacts as really the only one of his kind amongst 36 billion people. And we just don't get anything from him. And I was kind of disappointed by that.
He just disappears. Yeah.
Yeah.
I want the fanfic for how he landed on Earth and what happened.
Yeah, totally. I am curious if other books go more into that, because I do understand that he is in some of the other books. You know, plot reasons are why he's left behind, right? That Burton is trying to be incognito and, you know, the one alien around there is going to stick out. And he's trying to... I think he even changes his name, right? Burton does. He goes by some kind of Arabic sounding name.
Yeah, he goes like a Turkish name.
Oh, yeah, he does.
Because all he has to do is throw on a turban and then he's an Arab.
Well, and that's also true to what Burton did in real life.
I guess that's true.
He disguised himself and went to Mecca, right?
Right.
I think Farmer read the same Wikipedia entry that I read because the plot really tracks with Wikipedia.
It does.
I will say that the tomb that him and his wife are in, Isabel, it is actually really cool looking. If you look up an image of it, it's this Bedouin tent looking sculpture, and it's really cool. You should look it up. They reference it in the book, which is the only reason I looked it up, but it's neat.
And there's a picture of it on Wikipedia.
Oh, hey.
Sweet. So I was looking at some of the history of the book, and it was actually published in two different volumes, The Day of the Great Shout and The Suicide Express. And once I knew that, I kind of went, okay, I can, like, the experience of reading it, it's very different once he starts doing the trying to escape from the ethicals by committing suicide over and over.
Yeah, the pace is different. The motivations are different. Everything's different. Mm-hmm.
It's like a combination of Groundhog's Day and like a video game respawning, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought of more like video games.
Yeah, it's like, where will I pop up and what will happen? React immediately. Yeah.
So one thing that we mentioned that was mentioned earlier, and I can't remember if it was during the unfortunate time that we had earlier that we don't need to reference here because then it's just going to confuse people. But I'm going to do it anyway with some connection issues. The dream gum. That's something I definitely want to talk about because what's it for? You know, it's the first time they use it, right? People go on this big sexy times orgy spree kind of thing and tons of murder. And, you know, why? Why would that be? Why is that in the
grounds? Is it like an agent of chaos or something like that to ensure that there's some degree of chaos, which I don't actually think was necessary. I think people were going to probably find plenty of ways to screw things up without it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like, and how is it different from just having booze and other things and drugs available?
I mean, I guess having a hallucinogen, you know, narcotic is a little different than having cigarettes or marijuana or booze. I mean, it's apparently much more addictive than the other things were. So I think it probably excites a different part of your brain than the other ones do. It's addictive. Yeah. There's also references to the possibility that it helps you somehow get to the next level of whatever these people are trying to get to. Like if you take it enough, you can exercise your demons and go on, as they say.
Yeah.
It's very Scientology.
Yeah, it almost is, isn't it? I mean, it kind of lends to the interpretation of Riverworld as a kind of purgatory, where this is the, you know, you're at this place. And then once you reach a level of enlightenment or even like, yeah, kind of Buddhist ideas where you're trying to perfect yourself here. And you do have that kind of played out in the life of Goering, which I don't know about you guys, but, you know, the idea that you're going to have a character like Goering in there and not just as an antagonist. If he was just an antagonist, I would totally get it because everybody can get behind Nazis being the antagonist. But the way his character goes, you know, he kind of has a redemption path, and I'm not sure I'm on board with that.
Same.
And it definitely did seem like the gum was something that helped him along, even though it made him suffer as well. And that's kind of that purgatory thing.
Yeah, he kind of is the only one with much of an arc. It's true. Mm-hmm.
The fact that he chose a Nazi for the person that gets their redemptive arc is crazy to me. And it's either saying something very important, like no one is beyond redemption, or it's saying something really appalling, like what they did wasn't that bad.
Right.
And I don't think it's the latter, but if it's the former, it doesn't really come across all that well to me. I don't know.
Well, if you look at it from like a religious standpoint, isn't everybody able to get redemption?
Right.
If it's even the worst Nazis.
I mean, if you're Christians, I guess, yeah.
Yep. Which I am.
So, I mean, it's not that crazy of an idea. I kept wondering why he chose Goering and not Hitler. Maybe because Hitler was completely beyond redemption?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, they depict Goering as sort of half-hearted, that he was really just in it for the power, but didn't have any particular antipathy toward anyone.
Yeah, I definitely want to pick up on that because at some point, Burton, when he's being confronted about his anti-Semitic writings, you know, he does the classic defense. Well, you know, I have a lot of Jewish friends. You know, I'm right. Very friendly with lots of Jewish people. Yeah. And so I loved the fact that then later on when he met Goering and he knew about the Nazis, that he was very standoffish with him. I don't like you. You know, I've heard about what you people are like. And Goering basically says the same thing, right? Hey, no. You know, yep. I don't have anything particularly against the Jews. I have lots of Jewish friends. And it seemed like even Burton was like, ouch, okay, that hit too close to home.
Yeah. It says he reddened, which I was like, oh, is he learning an important truth right now?
Yeah.
Well, that's a great observation, guys.
Yay.
I think that just went right by me. Well, that makes me happy that Farmer gave us some recognition that this kind of behavior is bad.
Yeah. I was really interested that a book from, I mean, I don't know why I wouldn't expect it, but I was interested that a book from the late 60s, early 70s had that same thing that, oh, some of my best friends are Jews, some of my best friends are black. You know, that offhanded way of excusing something that you're doing that's bad, you know.
Yeah. People still use it today.
So. I know. That's why I was like, oh, yeah, that's like still a thing. Like everywhere.
Well, I guess, was that always a thing? Probably.
I guess so.
Probably.
I mean, no one wants to be told they're problematic. And sometimes people can have good intentions and bad actions.
And sometimes people really can't recognize it in themselves. And I think that's a way of, it's a defense mechanism, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, doesn't it happen with Goering at the end when he's in his, I guess, so-called good guy phase, and he's friendly with Burton and no longer a threat. But isn't that still at the point where he strangles the woman that he's taken up with?
Yeah.
And he doesn't really have a reason why, he just did. So I wonder if Farmer is telling us that maybe people have an inherent bad streak and it's got to have some kind of outlet. So even if he's getting along and kind of seeing the error of his ways, he's got to have some sort of outlet, which is going to be in this form, or because of course Farmer is kind of okay with violence against women and just throwing them away. So he's going to show us that he's actually still a bad guy through the totally unprovoked strangulation of his partner.
Oh, and that's really interesting, because if we accept that Frigate is the stand-in for Farmer, Frigate, the first thing we learn about him is that he has this really deeply buried streak of violence. And it's like, if I wonder if that's something that Farmer's, you know, analyzing about himself, using Goring kind of.
Sure.
To say that there's always this thing in you, and is it possible to ever really get rid of it? Or will it always be there?
Mm. That might be a good way to bring it back to the conversation about, is humanity just awful?
Yes.
Like, if it's one thing to be, you know, brutish, nasty, and short, as, you know, Thomas Hobbes says about life on Earth now because of limited resources and natural disasters and whatever else. But if you're, if we're all reborn into a world where we don't, where we don't die and everything is provided for, why would we still enslave? Yeah. Why would we still fight?
Well, we have both, right? That's kind of the nature of humanity. So you have, you have people who do bad things and you have people who do good things. And the doing of the bad and the doing of the good doesn't necessarily say anything about who you are. It's, you know, that's just what you do. But as Mr. Rogers told us, always look for the helpers. And there are people who are helping other people, even in this story. You know, Alice is taking on that little girl and people are protecting one another. And so even though there's a lot of bad, there's also a lot of good.
Yeah, I just want to know why we have that capacity for such evil when it's not even necessary.
Well, and Farmer drops some kind of heavy bombs on us, and then he just sort of casually walks away from them. You know, early in the book, when they first get their, everyone gets their first taste of the dream gum. Do they call it dream gum? Everyone gets their first taste of the dream gum, and it's just pandemonium. And they just sort of casually tell us that many children were raped or murdered. And then we find out later in the book that everybody who dies gets reborn, and children are going to continue to grow toward adulthood till age of 25-ish or whatever it is. So there are going to be kids who have this memory of being raped and murdered growing up into adults. So they're definitely not going to be set up for success in whatever it is that the ethicals are going for. And it's really just going to compound an awful lot of suffering. And we just kind of get that as a throwaway line that that happened. And so I was just sort of, well, I don't know. I was unhappy with that, that he sort of drops those awful things on us and then just walks away from it.
Yeah. And you know, you can't really square that with the idea of the, like the purgatory idea, right? Because these are children. It's not like they have a lifetime of doing evil to somehow atone for through suffering.
Right. They're at the oldest, they're five, I think, or that the youngest five?
Yeah, that's the youngest.
Yeah. It's a very original sin way of looking at, you know, it's a very Catholic way of looking at things. Like if you were born, then you have something you need to deal with, you know, and that's, there's a children's purgatory, you know, in Catholicism. And it doesn't matter that you haven't had any choice in the matter. You still are tainted, I guess.
Limbo.
I wonder if he's carrying some of that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I remember one part that stands out to me is like humans were teaching each other how to like outdo each other. Like I remember some 12th century people were learning from some Choctaw Indians about scalping. And I was just like, no, share the good stuff.
Well, yeah, like we were talking about earlier offline, you know, if you take the 36 billion figure, right, a good percentage of that is going to be people from more modern times. And yet there's still a significant portion of people who are just like pro-slavery. And really, you don't have to go back that far in our modern times to have that be a thing. And even in parts of the world, right, there's still slavery going on today. So it's not like we've solved it or anything. But yeah, in lots of places that you go along the river, as we find out in the book, you're going to find grail slavery. And that kind of feeds back into what you were talking about, Haley, where this is a post-scarcity society because everybody's got the grail. You should be able to, you know, have your basic physical needs met. And yet people who are more ambitious and want more, you know, and are like, hey, you know what? Less is more, but more is even more, right? Are going to steal from them and take the best parts of what's in the grails and just leave the people with the minimum subsistence to keep them alive and keep them working. And it's a depressing thought.
There was a line in Dune. We just recorded Dune, and there was a line in Dune that was like, I believe it was the Baron Harkonnen was like, the point is power. And I think that's that carries into this too. It's not that they have anything to fight for, you know, the point is power. They want to be the one that's in charge. They want to be the one that has the power. And it, you know, and it, I don't think any of us are really immune from that. Given it's hard to say what any of us would do in these situations. I don't think that I would enslave people, but I might. I don't know. Like thrown into a completely new environment that I have no idea what to do. I don't know how I'd react.
I keep thinking about, so I'm a big fan of boats, and I want to know how they made these boats out of reeds, and like they have double keels, and
where were the engineers?
I want to
see the engineering drawings.
Yeah.
I want to know how they knew they'd float. Where? Right. How many sails?
They had a they had a forecastle. How does a boat with made out of reeds have a forecastle?
Well, I thought it was interesting that they said they called it the forecastle, and it really wasn't one.
Right.
So we just got back from us three went to New Bedford, Massachusetts for the annual Moby Dick reading marathon.
Oh, nice.
So I still have boats on the brain.
I just saw that Farmer wrote some fanfic about Ishmael. I just emailed it to you guys. It's called the
Farmer did?
Yeah, it's called The Wind Wails of Ishmael. Huh. Ishmael, lone survivor of the doomed whaling ship Pequod, falls through a rift in time and space to a future Earth.
Definitely reading that.
All right. I'm just kind of looking down my notes to see what else stuck out to me, but I would definitely like to. I know you guys normally have segments like feminist hero and misogynist moment.
None.
I had a feminist favorite, actually, you guys. I had one.
All right, let's hear it.
Wait. I gotta find it. Hold on one second.
I mean, I guess theoretically it could be when Alice takes care of that girl, but that's also what women always do. So.
Right.
It was when Wilfreda, so they picked up Wilfreda, the erstwhile whore, and they're around the fire, and Richard, he's like, I really want Alice, but I also really want Wilfreda, but I don't think I can have Alice, but what do I do? What do I do? And so he goes over and tries to mack on Alice, and she's like, sir, no, thank you. And then he goes around the fire and tries to mack on Wilfreda, and she's like, you can move on, Sir Richard. I don't want to be anybody's second choice. Thank you very much. No. And it was my feminist favorite for a second, but then later she's like, okay. And then that was it.
Well, here's what else we know about Wilfreda. It's under my long list of misogynist moments. She's coarsely pretty. Does anyone know what that means?
Coarsely
I don't know what
pretty.
That means.
I'm assuming she's like a redneck.
She needs some moisturizer.
Yeah, she needs some moisturizer. She needs some conditioner.
Her skin is literally coarse. She has sparkling eyes. She's tall, blue-eyed, and has a handsome face, a well-curved figure, and one of my favorite phrases from the book, a splendid bust.
I figured coarsely attractive meant she'd look good in soft focus. Like the ladies on original Star Trek.
I think coarsely...
She needs like a Facetune, filter.
Oh, do you know what took me out of this book a lot? I don't know how much you're familiar, Seth, with drag culture, but every time they said, yes,
holy,
yes,
I was like, come through.
And I would always start talking out loud because I was like, well, maybe they pronounce it differently. Like, yes. I was trying to think of ways that wasn't, yes, queen.
No, it was yes, queen every time. Every time.
That's amazing.
No, I am still dumbfounded by like, well, maybe it's yes. Mm-hmm.
There's no other way to pronounce it. It's just
yas. I had that little feminist favorite, and I also had a feminist favorite when Alice makes her clothes. I thought that was a little bit of a she was living her truth. She's like, I need to be clothed. I'm going to make these clothes out of this grass. It's going to suck, but that's what I need to do. She didn't stick with it very long, much like Wilfreda and her saying no to Richard. But it was a good moment.
Oh. Coarsely pretty actually just stirred up a memory in me. A good friend of mine, when I was in law school, she was getting a master's degree, and we both shared our misadventures in dating, and she said that she went on a date with this guy and he was okay, and he described her as prairie pretty. And I feel like that's coarsely attractive. Prairie pretty.
No.
It's like you're pretty, but you've had a hard time of things.
Yeah, this was 2009, so I don't know what he meant. He lived in Athens, Georgia. It wasn't in the 1880s.
Prairie pretty.
Yeah. I think about prairie pretty a lot, because sometimes I'll see people on MARTA, and I'm like, oh, she's prairie pretty. So I mean, I'm guilty of it, too. So.
Was she like... carrying a shotgun and she had some animal pelts thrown over her shoulder, like survivalist pretty.
She was just a hipster. She had freckles, maybe because she had freckles. I don't know.
Like she was windblown and like she wore a lot of muslin.
Oh gosh.
I think prairie pretty sounds amazing, but I think he meant it as like a neg. So
it's like Laura Ingalls Wilder, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a note on Alice and her grass clothes. I have a quote from what Burton thinks of her grass clothes. He says, well, initially, he tells us that she would be beautiful if she had hair and that she has a handsome aristocratic face, a magnificent body, and a superb shape. But, and this is a direct quote from Sir Richard Francis Burton, once dressed in shapeless grass garments, her face suddenly became masculine and ugly.
Yeah, I remember that.
I don't know what's in that grass.
Man, he's so lazy with his adjectives. A magnificent figure. Like, come on.
Well, let me tell you my favorite thing about his writing is how often he uses the word moreover. He uses the moreover all the time. And my absolute favorite line from this whole book is when Alice decides to move in with Richard after he saves her from Goring. Or saves her from Goring. That's an overstatement, but because she frankly kills Goring herself. Feminist favorite. Anyway, he uses the word moreover a lot. And my favorite line is when she's like, here's why I'm moving in with you. Here's the five very logical reasons. And moreover, I love you.
Save the best for last.
Moreover, I love you.
Yeah. I was not at all sure what to make of the fact that, like, she was in captivity, probably being violated, this made her more receptive to Burton. And I'm like, you don't think there would be some psychological effects of that?
Oh, God. Horrible.
Oh, of course there would be, but Farmer doesn't know what they are, you know? So he's just going to have this woman move in with this dude. That's the way it goes, right?
I hope a lot of 20th century and 21st century therapists are populated equally throughout the river world to help address people's trauma.
Yeah, they are probably severely overworked.
Well, you know Freud's there somewhere. He's probably got the right aura. Sorry.
She can't. It's too funny. It's too funny.
I'd forgotten about this part where they were kind of all paired off. And Frigate has this woman named Logu, or however you pronounce it.
Oh, I have so many notes.
She follows him into the woods and like tries to get Richard to sleep with her. And Richard's like, he has this moment of morality and he's like, I will never betray Frigate or any member of the crew. And it's like, Logo says, it's not like that she didn't love Frigate. It's just she needs to change just like Frigate did. And it was like, is that a feminist moment?
Maybe people are all people. Maybe men and women aren't so different. It's a little glimpse of that.
It's a little glimpse of feminism.
Do you guys like to hear my notes on Logo?
Yes, please.
Yes, please.
Beautiful body. Large, dark green eyes. Ooh, and I said that I felt like it was a Trump tweet. Large, dark green eyes. Lips a little too thick for beauty, but other features exquisite. Slightly slanted eyes. And this is my personal favorite. She had a beautifully rounded posterior. Specifically, her buttocks were like two eggs.
Oh my God. Hey, Lori, you know what I wrote next to that in my book? Was it's just like Belinda's pomegranates.
Are you familiar, Seth, with the podcast My Dad Wrote a Porno?
I've heard of it, but I've not listened to it.
Yeah. It is very, very, very funny. Not safe for work. Not safe for kids. Earbuds only. Yeah. But it is very, very funny. And there are kind of similar descriptions of women's bodies.
Like his grasp of female anatomy is about the same as the author of the book at the heart of My Dad Wrote a Porno.
Arguably less informed, because there's no detail that's gives any sort of actual glimpse into what a woman actually looks like besides magnificent or splendid.
It's like in 40-Year-Old Virgin when he describes bags of sand.
Bags of sand. Right. I don't know, though, Haley. I think I have to take issue with that. Her buttocks were like two eggs is pretty specific. Well, I don't know if I'll ever recover from that description. All butts are just pairs of eggs to me now.
I think about this. So I think like the first paragraph of Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston, and this has stuck with me my entire life. The main character, I forget the name, maybe Janie, I forget, but Zora Neale Hurston, noted feminist, describes her butt as like two melons fighting in a croaker sack.
Oh, that's like in Steel Magnolias when she says that woman who's wearing that dress, it looks like two pigs fighting under a blanket.
Yeah. So, I mean, women have done it too. But, yep. Yeah.
No, Farmer's descriptions remind me of like Captain Holt from Brooklyn Nine-Nine describing.
I was about to say that, Seth.
Yeah.
Yes, he's like, her heavy breasts.
Yes.
And that's like all he knows how to say about
women.
She's
a strong female woman with heavy breasts. Heavier than usual.
Breasts. Her heavy breasts.
Heavier than usual.
It's hilarious. That show is a gem. Everyone should watch it.
Heavier than average, I think, is the quote, actually.
Heavier than average.
Yeah.
I like the idea that there's an average heft.
Growing up in a house with three sisters, you know, there was a lot of, and my mom's a nurse, and so our discussions around the dinner table could range to the very embarrassing if any of my friends were over, just because there was constant talks about everything imaginable.
Poor Kevin, Lori's husband Kevin can relate, I think, a bit. Haley and Lori and I tend to hang around and talk about a lot of things, and Kevin's always got to hear it.
Yep.
So y'all can commiserate.
It makes you stronger.
I liked keeping track of everything that Richard Burton knew. That was my favorite thing. Like he knew Tuscan, Asiatic, Icelandic, devoted. He was devoted to enumeration. He knew the Polynesian language. He knew dendrology. He knew botany. He knew everything. American dialects, Austrian, German, circumcision practices of various cultures.
Speaking of that, that's in his Wikipedia entry. Apparently, he, as an adult, underwent circumcision so that he could blend in with a non-European culture that escapes me at the moment because he did a lot of cultural tourism incognito.
Farmer right. or Burton?
So, Burton.
Okay.
So he probably did know a thing or two about other cultural traditions and circumcision.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, everything you read, all in Wikipedia. You know, maybe somebody just read this novel and then wrote his Wikipedia.
Oh, he's also a psychic. I forgot about this. He can do lichen identification, homeopathy, how to read the sun, how to remove himself from reality. He is a psychic. He knows hypnotism.
Psychic not in the Wikipedia.
So we should probably talk about the ethicals, although I do want to have the full download of the misogynist moments at some point, although we may not have enough tape.
I don't think we have enough time. We don't have time, Seth.
Yeah, so I read the book, I finished it last week, and then I found actually a version of the audiobook on YouTube and listened to the end of it again. And for the life of me, I can't remember what we actually learn about what's going on Riverworld. Because you have a couple times where there's the, I think he's the, you know, capital letters, mysterious stranger who comes and tells Burton that they're looking for him. And that mm-hmm. kind of springs off into his riding the Suicide Express to move around. But then the other information we get, I'm not sure how much of it to take as canon and, or just like, this is what he was told at that time.
I don't think you can know, because it's really hard to say whether they're, you know, feeding him a bunch of hooey or if they're telling him the truth. Cause they take him up to the circular room and he's sitting there and they're like, it seems to be some sort of a mishmash between a scientific experiment. And also they hint that there's a way to salvation basically, but we don't get much more than that.
And that may be just leaving the breadcrumbs to try and lead you to the other books.
Yeah, and the implication is that the mysterious stranger is somehow trying to thwart the ethicals because he doesn't think what they're doing is ethical.
Right.
But you don't really know what his game plan is either. Like, what's his end game? We don't know.
Right. Other than he definitely is trying to thwart them. And I like that he gets a pretty good, long, basically villain monologue from the ethicals in that room who tell him, you're not even going to remember this, so we might as well tell you the whole plan. And then he, of course, does remember it.
Right. Which I guess he ascribes to the mysterious stranger. He's like, well, someone wanted me to remember. And then he goes off on his quest that we don't follow him on at the end of the book to find out what's really going on. So we just don't know. I mean, I can only assume it's left vague on purpose to make you read the rest of the books, like you said.
One thing that I did enjoy is that the rogue ethical guy, the mysterious stranger, you know, it's not like he was all powerful or anything, because he had his plan. Hey, the first time he dies, I'm going to resurrect him at the headwaters and maybe he'll get to the Dark Tower or whatever it was they called it. And he's immediately grievously injured by these, you know, gigantic, I don't know,
right.
Prehumans or maybe in the 70s, we thought that
missing
they were
links. I assumed they were Sasquatch.
Oh, that's cool. I was thinking they were like the Nephilim from the Bible or something.
Oh, that's cooler.
Yeah, but I wasn't sure about it.
You thought the Ethicals were like Sasquatch?
No, the first time that he resurrects, and there's giants there. They're all fighting each other.
That's my fault. I lost the thread for a second.
That would be a different take if you were going to do an adaptation, you know, with everybody in Chewbacca uniforms, you know?
There's like a conference room with a bunch of Bigfoot sitting around the table. Yeah. Discussing the future of humanity. All they've done is taken pictures of us, blurry pictures of us, play Jack Link's tricks on us in commercials.
They're tired of it.
we didn't know that the forthcoming Riverworld adaptation is part of the Harry and the Henderson cinematic universe.
There's actually Loch Ness monsters in the river.
It's payback time.
Yeah. It's all, what are they called?
Cryptids?
What are they called? Yeah. Yes. It's a whole world of cryptids. Hmm. Also, did anybody else picture the river as a little bit like Rendezvous from Rama? Just me? Okay. In my head, this river world is basically Freedom Park in Atlanta with a river in it.
That goes on and on forever. Yeah, I didn't imagine too much about landforms or anything. I was just always sort of imagining a riverbank. Because it seems like wherever they were on a riverbank. And I wondered, like, they just made a... If they traveled perpendicular to the river, if they would end up somewhere else.
Yeah.
Maybe there were mountains off in the distance.
Have you read Ringworld yet, Seth?
Yes. Yeah, recently.
I kind of picture it as like a cross between the Ringworld universe and also like the arena in the Hunger Games, where like there's just like an edge to it that you can't get past. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, the descriptions of the geography aren't very detailed and not very evocative. And so it didn't encourage me to have a mental image of what was going on there, other than, you know, there's these super high mountains. But at some point I was like, well, would a guy from that time, like if it was a skyscraper, would he just think it was a mountain? So I wondered about some of that stuff. But then he had someone like Frigate there who would have recognized if it was just a cityscape or something. But the other thing, it got me thinking about the geophysics of it. And this is where, you know, I get all nerdy, because I'm thinking about a massive river going along a kind of a never-ending gorge. You'd think there should be erosion of the banks, and eventually it's just going to erode all the way back to the foot of the mountains. And then you don't have any plains along the river.
If it was, there doesn't seem to be a lot of curving of this river. And normally you get, erosion happens on that one side of the river where it curves, and that's how rivers move. But this one just seemed to be straight. It had some lakes, but on the whole, it just seemed to be straight. And I also was thinking it must be that if they engineered this world, then they could potentially engineer it in such a way that kind of thing doesn't happen. But I don't know how they would fend off the natural effect of water, but that's the only thing I could think of for that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But I also thought about that, so you're not alone.
Are there other things that you would normally bring up in a conversation on Hugo Girl?
Let's see. I have my schedule.
Star Wars.
Oh, yeah. Did either of you look at and find anything interesting on Goodreads?
Oh, I forgot.
I looked. All the one-star reviews that I read were all women saying, I tried to read it and I could not because of the rampant misogyny. Mm-hmm. I read like 10 to 15 and that was all of them. It was crazy.
I have a number one misogynist moment.
Oh, here we go. The winner.
And it might actually be too gross to share, but so you have Burton and Alice and Frigate sitting around talking. And of course, let's recall that Frigate is farmer. Frigate says, they're talking about eventually there will be a world with no children once all of the children have grown up. And Frigate says, but what about those whose only sexual objects are children? What will they do when there are no more children?
Oi.
Lori.
What's that about?
I almost threw the book across the room. Like, are they sympathetic to them? Are they just idly curious?
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know either.
Well, he goes on as just curious.
Won't someone please think of the pedophile?
Well, he goes on to say, what about people who get their kicks by mistreating and torturing animals? And then he says, I'm so glad that there won't be any animals around, so there won't be any animals to be abused and hurt by bad people. But they just leave the thing about the kids.
The kids.
Yeah.
That's one of those things that I had on my list of upsetting bombs that Farmer drops on us and then just walks away from them.
File that under WTF.
So that's my number one misogynist moment.
I would like to... I, I think my number one misogynist moment might be the fact that he keeps saying that the women come back as virgins. And I just want to visit that.
I didn't realize that. I think I forgot that.
Obviously, you can't erase the fact that the women had sex during their lifetimes. So all right. I can assume is that he means they come back with intact hymens.
Right.
And what?
Yeah.
What does that say? Like, does it mean that now they're pure and therefore can attain salvation? Like, what is the point of bringing them back with an intact hymen, I ask?
Oh my God, Amy, in spite of all of my detailed misogynist moment notes, that passed me by. I think it was too awful for me to absorb. And
he lumps it with, so there's one part where he says, all men had awakened from death circumcised. All women had been resurrected as virgins. For most women, Burton commented, this state had not lasted beyond the first night on this planet. It's like, so circumcision and virginity are somehow joined up in Burton's head. And I don't know if it has something to do with purity, like some sort of, or some sort of cleanliness thing. But it is really weird to me that that's what, I mean, it's not that weird. I guess it doesn't really surprise me that much. But he's somehow equating this with their ability to attain salvation, I think, or their worthiness of being resurrected in the first place. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Troubling.
Definitely.
Very troubling. Also, I underlined that Alice Hargreaves, she was the product of her society. Like all women, she was what men had made her.
Right. Goodness. As I understand it, the real Alice Hargreaves was the inspiration for Alice in Wonderland.
Yes. And fun fact, we share a birthday.
Oh, nice.
Oh, you and the real Alice Hargreaves?
Yes, Alice Liddell.
Oh, neat.
Hargreaves, I believe, is her married name.
Anything else, guys?
Well, I mean, the book doesn't really end, so.
This doesn't need to end either.
We can just,
oh, no, I'm wrong. Hargreaves was her real name. Liddell was her married
right,
name.
Right, yeah. I will say that when you're talking about the Goodreads one-star reviews, have you covered any Retro Hugos yet?
No.
No.
So the most recent Retro Hugo went to Conjure Wife by Fritz Lieber, and it's outstandingly sexist.
I saw your tweet about it.
Yeah, it is amazing. And Emily, who is my co-host from Take Me to Your Reader, James's wife, usually reads along with us if she can, or at least watches. We usually go over to their house to watch the movies, and she just could not. She couldn't do it. The movies, she's just like, they're all just terrible. They're terribly sexist. And like, she couldn't get past it. And I totally get it.
It just takes you out of the story, you know? I mean, yeah. I get like trying to visit these things, you know, with giving them a little bit of the benefit of their time, you know, like giving them a little bit of what am I trying to say? The phrase went out of my head. What is it when
you're going to give them a little latitude?
Benefit of the doubt.
Yeah. Benefit of the doubt. That's what I was trying to
right.
say. Cut them. But I think it's, you give them a little latitude because they're being written in a certain time and they're going to have the mores of the time in their book. But man, does it takes you right out of the story.
I mean,
it just really does. And it's,
this book was written like after Ursula Le Guin, who wrote a science fiction book about an adventure that was not sexist. So,
right.
That's true. These ideas, the ideas that women are people, that was present in the popular culture at the time that this was written.
I mean, he had the benefit of Amelia Earhart, you know? I mean, he could have done so many things.
Okay, well, how about we go into final thoughts?
So, do you guys want to close with our Star Wars or Lord of the Rings?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes,
all right. So, what do we think? Is this Star Wars or is this Lord of the Rings? I think it's Lord of the Rings.
Star Wars.
I think it's Lord of the Rings.
There's a quest, although we don't really know what it's for. There's a motley crew of friends traveling around together, fighting duels.
So I've been listening to your podcast for a while, and I haven't figured out, is there a hard and fast set of, you know, check boxes that make it fall into one or the other?
No.
We never have one of those.
Purely, purely subjective.
Sometimes it's just like a feeling you get. Sometimes if there's just horses. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Well, for a second, I was thinking maybe Burton had a hero's journey, but he really doesn't. He starts out with everything he needs and just sort of barrels through. It's not really a hero's journey,
well,
is it?
Well, there's a hero's journey in both movies, too, so...
We have one extraterrestrial point for Star Wars.
Yeah.
Sometimes I like to say things are Lord of the Rings if I don't if I just don't like them because I don't like Lord of the Rings. So I'm going to put this with Lord of the Rings. And it's not that I don't like the book, but it's weird.
No, it is that you don't like the book.
No, I mean, I love the ideas in the book. So,
but you don't like hobbits.
I don't like hobbits. I feel like...
Is Kaz a hobbit?
This seems very pastoral, which reminds me of Lord of the Rings, so...
Kaz is a hobbit. Yeah.
Kaz is kind of a hobbit. And also, the ethicals are a little bit like wizards, so...
There's not a ton of women. Lord of the Rings has Cate Blanchett, right? And Aerosmith's daughter, so... Those are the only two I know.
Aerosmith's daughter! There's also Eowyn. She's important. She is no man.
Yeah, and actually,
that's Cate
the women
Blanchett.
That Lord of the Rings does have are quality women.
Yeah, but there's not a lot of them.
Yeah. I think I would lean Star Wars just because of the, you know, the technology aspect of it and the technological reincarnation kind of thing. But yeah, it pulls a little from both.
It's definitely more sci-fi than fantasy. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you think so? I think it could be magic.
Yeah.
Hmm? Afterlife. Yeah. I mean, that seems more magic than technology. I think we don't know.
Yeah.
Or maybe we're meant to see it as technology since they're all in like a matrix rotating on spits like chickens.
Mm-hmm. I think they're all just they're just at the Shire.
Well, it was like they were all being 3D printed before being,
yes, it is like that.
Yeah, because when he first wakes up there, he looks over and one of them next to him is just like doesn't have any skin yet, and like in the Fifth Element,
he's being printed. Yeah,
yeah. I was just about to say that. Like, yeah, like it goes bit by bit, and then it's the perfect being, and it's Mila Jovovich.
Yeah. Now, Leeloo would have made a huge difference in this book.
Yes. Oh, Leeloo. Love her. Multipass. I was just thinking about in Rendezvous with Rama when they finally bust into one of the towers inside the ship, and that has all those templates for like typewriters and food and phones and stuff. I imagine that this is the same way they're doing it when they like fill those grails. It's like they have the little templates for steak and marijuana.
Seems like we're split on Lord of the Rings, Star Wars.
Yep.
And that's okay because we have no rules.
Right.
And since the book doesn't end, we don't have to come up with a choice.
Also, right. Good point.
Well, we do have to come up with this choice, right? And I'm curious just to kind of, we mentioned this earlier. Is anybody here planning to read further in the series?
I might check it out if they have some at the local used bookstore.
Doubt it. After I got mad at the Samuel Clemens turn.
Yeah.
Lori, do you hate Mark Twain?
No, I just wanted to know what happens in this story, and it made me mad that...
I bet nothing happens. I think this is where we differ, so y'all are very plot-focused. I am not. But by the same token, I've never once guessed the ending to anything I've ever read or watched. So I think I just have an ability just to get in there and like sit with it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was 100% certain when I started reading this book that it was going to end up that the humans had actually found the Tal Seton's ability to keep people alive forever and that this was it.
Hmm.
So I was totally wrong.
Yeah, I didn't. This one, for some reason, for me, didn't inspire a lot of trying to guess what was going to come next in it. I was along for the journey. And
yeah,
I may at some point pick up, I mean, since I already own the Fabulous Riverboat, I might sometime when I'm on a plane or something, give it a read. But this is the problem with having a couple of podcasts where you have to read books is that I don't have that much time for extracurricular reading.
Aww. Tweet us if it's good.
Okay, I will let you know.
If you recommend it, I might give it a try. But I'm getting used to the idea that maybe I should expect from some of these books to not be so wed to the plot and that I'm just kind of sitting with interesting ideas. And I do like that, but I keep getting mad. It was the same with the Rendezvous with Rama, which I guess you may want to edit that out since you haven't done it on your show yet. But I was just very excited to get to the end and find out what's the answer. And then I was like, I just gave you a whole weekend. I sat here all day Saturday and all day Sunday in my little chair, turning pages as fast as I could because I was very excited to find out the answer. And there was no answer. And I was just so disappointed by that. But I guess I just need to get over it.
As like a palate cleanser, you should read like Gone Girl afterwards immediately.
Yeah.
Comes full circle.
Nice.
I will say, it looks like Farmer writes a lot of like fanfic, science fiction fanfic. Like he has this Wind Whales of Ishmael, which is a sequel to Moby Dick. He has The Other Log of Phileas Fogg, which fills in the time periods and Around the World in 80 Days. He has some Wizard of Oz fanfic, it looks like. So I don't know. I'd be interested to check out some of that stuff. Huh.
Seems like he just liked to play around with historical and literary characters.
That's cool.
Yeah, which I can get behind.
Cool. All right. I'm not exactly sure how signing off works for this one. I guess for kind of signing off on for the Hugo's There portion of this, where can people follow you guys?
We are at Hugo Girl Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And we're HugoGirlPodcast@gmail.com. And you can subscribe on, I think we're on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify. What else are we on, guys?
Pocket Casts.
And then we just got on Castro Podcasts, I think, recently. Somebody actually requested that, so that was fun.
Nice.
There's another one, too. You should be able to find us most anywhere.
Well, also for my listeners, do you have any inside information on what you're going to be hitting next?
The Man in the High Castle will be our February episode.
Yeah, you mentioned that in your Dune episode. Well, I always look forward to listening to your episodes if they're ones that I've already covered, or at least a book that I've already read. this came up in, I can't remember which episode it was, where you mentioned Hugo's there and tried to find a different word than taint to use.
Which is unsuccessfully.
Yes, unsuccessfully. And that, I got a good laugh out of that one, I can tell you. But yeah, I like to keep my thoughts and then just kind of have the conversation with my guest and let my guest take it where I want them to, and not be too colored by what I've heard from other analyses of it. So I always cue your episodes up, or in the future after I've done an episode. So fortunately I have a head start. So
yeah, you definitely do.
Well, I want to thank you guys for, being willing to do this and figure out the schedule. It's not always the easiest thing to get scheduling together with four people, although I guess you're used to doing three. So thank you.
Well, thanks so much for having us. This is fun.
Yeah.
This is delightful.
Yeah, it's good stuff, despite the technical difficulties, which I've referenced a couple times and in the edit probably won't show at all. So
we've overcome.
Yes, we have.
I believed in us from the beginning.
Yes. So, yeah.
Sorry. We usually just wind down and say goodbye.
Yeah, that sounds good. Okay. Goodbye. Goodbye.
All right.
Goodbye.
Bye. Goodbye.
Well, everyone, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with the wonderful ladies of Hugo Girl. And I absolutely recommend that you subscribe to their podcast. I'll put their details in the show notes. But, if you enjoy what I do here, you're virtually guaranteed to enjoy what they do there. I feel like our episodes complement each other very well, and they've covered a few of the same titles that I've done. So head right over there and listen to those episodes. Of course, also, if you enjoy what I'm doing here, then I encourage you to go check out the Patreon, patreon.com/Hugo's Podcast. You can support for as little as $1 a month. And the fun thing about it is when you sign up as a patron, you not only get access to anything that I put there for the Hugo's podcast specifically, you also get everything that I do for Take Me to Your Reader and Brief and Not So Brief. So you kind of get three podcasts for the price of one by supporting me on Patreon. At this point, I haven't done a ton of bonus content, but I am working on it. So you can get it on the ground floor. So I'd really appreciate that. Of course, if you can't support me financially, if you would retweet the episode, if you would tell your friends about it, I'd really appreciate that. I also want to put out a plea here for Take Me to Your Reader. We had some trouble with our RSS feed recently, and I think we've lost some subscribers because of that. So if you're somebody who regularly listens to all my podcasts, and you've been wondering what happened to Take Me to Your Reader, we are producing new episodes. We're up to episode 86 as I'm recording this. So you should be seeing those podcasts in your player. If you're not, then you may need to resubscribe to the podcast. So if you want to do that, that's great. Also, if you're a listener to Hugo's There and Take Me to Your Reader, the same information about, sharing episodes on social media stands for that as well. So if you do that, I'd really appreciate it. And of course, I appreciate everybody who just is out there lurking, listening. I'd love to know you're there. But if I don't, I still want to say thank you for listening. And I think that's going to do it for this time. So I'll talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kusky. Otherwise, we could just go in the order the tracks are shown. So Lori, Amy, Haley.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, wait. I think your tracks are in different order.
Oh, are they?
Yeah. Mine shows as Amy, Lori, Haley.
Let's just use some vocal cues.
Well, but on mine, they're this way. And, if we learned anything from this book, you should always just follow what the man wants to do. So.